the civilian government that she has direct authority has been actually very much complicit in publishing inflammatory and dehumanizing articles against the Rohingya.
Rohingya repatriation to begin as Myanmar's de facto leader is stripped of an honor. It's Tuesday, November 13th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, more South China Sea concerns, terror in Australia, Mumbai's slum kids reach up and out, higher learning holograms, personal robot assistants. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Leading international human rights group Amnesty International is stripping Myanmar leader Aung San Suu Kyi of its top honor over her failure to speak out or halt grave atrocities against her country's Rohingya Muslim population. VOA United Nations correspondent Margaret Bashir has more.
Amnesty awarded the former pro-democracy activist and longtime political prisoner its top honor in 2009. Amnesty's Asia-Pacific advocacy manager, Francisco Bencosme, told VOA his organization is deeply disappointed in Aung San Suu Kyi for not forcefully speaking out for the Rohingya and other minority groups in Myanmar.
We gave her the award in 2009, in part because we felt, and it was our expectation, that as an ambassador of conscience, she would continue to use her moral authority to speak out against injustice around the world, but in particular in Myanmar.
From 1989 to 2010, Myanmar's military-led government repeatedly confined Aung San Suu Kyi to house arrest. During that time, Western governments and human rights groups, including Amnesty, continuously advocated for her release. But since becoming the country's de facto civilian leader in April 2016, Aung San Suu Kyi and her administration have failed to condemn or try to stop atrocities perpetrated by the military against minority Rohingya residents in Rakhine State. In August 2017, the military unleashed a scorched-earth campaign on Rohingya villages in response to attacks by Rohingya militants that killed a dozen police officers. More than 700,000 Rohingya fled the violence to neighboring Bangladesh, where survivors have given horrific accounts of violence. The United Nations has called the atrocities a textbook case of ethnic cleansing.
As we've seen with her own civilian government, they've been creating hostility against the Rohingya, labeling them as terrorists, accusing them of burning their own houses, and faking rape. So the state media, the civilian government that she has direct authority, has been actually very much complicit in publishing inflammatory and dehumanizing articles against the Rohingya.
Past recipients of Amnesty's Ambassador of Conscience Award include South Africa's Nelson Mandela, Pakistani education advocate Malala Yousafzai, and Chinese dissident Ai Weiwei. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
A year after a bilateral agreement was signed, Myanmar is preparing to receive this week the first of thousands of Muslim Rohingya who fled a security crackdown last year for Bangladesh. An exodus of some 700,000 flowed into Bangladesh to escape violence in Myanmar's western Rakhine State in the wake of the crackdown after militants attacked security forces in August 2017. Myanmar said it is expecting the first of some 2,251 Rohingya to return beginning Thursday, followed by another 2,095. They are to be housed in transit camps and then another location where they will be housed and fed and given national verification cards. The Myanmar Social Welfare Relief and Resettlement Minister, Win Myat Aye, said the repatriation is dependent on Bangladesh as to whether it takes place. Bangladesh insisted any repatriation will be voluntary and no one will be forced to return. Vikram Nehru, a distinguished practitioner in residence at the Johns Hopkins University, tells VOA's Victor Beatty he remains skeptical this effort will even take place.
Because while the Myanmar authorities may have announced that they are ready to receive, you know, several thousand Rohingya refugees, first of all, it's not clear whether the refugees themselves feel safe enough to return home. And secondly, I think as far as the international community is concerned, a precondition for the return of the refugees should be some international oversight to ensure the security of these refugees once they return. After all, these refugees would be returning to an environment which has been traditionally extremely hostile to them, where they've had no security of person, no security of rights of any kind, no security for their property, and no economic security. And unfortunately, this hostility has occurred in the central government, in the military, amongst the police force, by the state government, and by civil society groups, especially the militant Buddhist groups in Myanmar. So unless there are guarantees for their security underwritten by the international community, I'm not sure whether there would be many Rohingyas willing to go back and risk their life and limb on the basis of a promise by the Myanmar authorities.
In fact, the UN and some rights groups say conditions are not yet safe for their return.
The history of antagonism and violence towards the Rohingyas by the mainstream Bamar groups as well as by the government is a long one. It's a history that goes back decades, if not even centuries. So the reality is that if these Rohingyas are to go back, they really should go back with some international guarantee for their safety. And that is something that I believe the United Nations should discuss and negotiate with the Myanmar authorities. I can understand why the Myanmar military would be reluctant to allow this. But without such a guarantee, I cannot imagine the Rohingya willing to risk their families once again, just in case, you know, something were to happen. After all, the situation there remains a tinderbox, and even a small spark could set it ablaze again. So it's a potentially dangerous situation. And I dare say very few, if any, Rohingya are going to take up the invitation of the Myanmar authorities.
A statement by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees called on the Myanmar government to allow refugees to go and see for themselves the conditions that will greet them before making an independent assessment about whether to return. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now on voanews.com. Amnesty International strips Aung San Suu Kyi of honor over Rohingya abuses. Meth seizures up in Myanmar and across Southeast Asia. Indonesian migrant workers remain vulnerable, activists say. A think tank says North Korea keeps undeclared missile bases up and running. Dialogue eases Sino-U.S. relations for now. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more can be found on Facebook. You can also visit our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Ahead of the U.S.-ASEAN summit in mid-November, Southeast Asian nations have expressed concerns about mounting tensions between Washington and Beijing. They point out to the U.S. Sino-tariff war, increasingly aggressive rhetoric from both governments, and a recent incident involving the two countries' warships. White House correspondent Patsy Wittikaswara has more.
In September, the U.S. Navy destroyer, the USS Decatur, had a close call with a Chinese warship. The Luyang came within 40 meters of the American vessel's bow, prompting it to maneuver to prevent a collision. The incident near a Chinese-claimed reef in the South China Sea added to tensions between Washington and Beijing.
Despite such reckless harassment, the United States Navy will continue to fly, sail, and operate wherever international law allows and our national interests demand. We will not be intimidated, and we will not stand down.
China has expanded its control over much of the South China Sea in recent years, building military bases and airstrips on tiny islands and reefs. The United States and its allies have responded with freedom of navigation exercises near Beijing's disputed claims to ensure that China does not block sea and air traffic. China challenges these exercises.
Recently, there have been similar incidents with a British warship. There have been incidents with others. And in response, not just the United States, but Australia, the United Kingdom, and other countries have all said they plan to continue sailing through these waters and just putting up with the Chinese, what they would call Chinese harassment.
Not just putting up, but also beefing up. Early this month, the USS Ronald Reagan aircraft carrier joined Japanese destroyers for the biggest combat readiness war game in the region. Trump has promised a more aggressive U.S. approach.
So we're not on the cusp of the United States being displaced by China as a global power, but we may be on the cusp of a real struggle for primacy in and around China's neighborhood.
So far, the Chinese and American military leadership are still communicating, which indicates neither country wants confrontation.
To ease tensions in the South China Sea, China and ASEAN member states conducted their first joint maritime exercises last month. ASEAN is also preparing for similar exercises with the United States for the first time next year. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, at the White House.
Happening now in Asia, a warplane from the aircraft carrier USS Ronald Reagan crashed into the sea northeast of the Philippines Monday. Its two aviators were rescued safely. The U.S. Navy's 7th Fleet said the FA-18 Hornet had a mechanical problem during Monday's routine operations in the Philippine Sea. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thank you for joining us today. Australian investigators say a Somali-born man who stabbed bystanders in the center of Melbourne on Friday had been inspired and radicalized by the militant group calling itself Islamic State. As we reported yesterday, Hassan Khalif Shire Ali was shot by police and later died in a hospital. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Somali-born migrant Hassan Khalif Shire Ali crashed his car that was packed with gas bottles in the heart of Australia's second biggest city. He stabbed three people. A 74-year-old restaurant owner died at the scene, and two other people are being treated in hospital. Neither are in a serious condition. Cell phone video shows the knife-wielding attacker lunging at two policemen in a busy Melbourne street. He is eventually shot at close range by one of the officers. He died later in hospital. Authorities say Shire Ali had previously had his Australian passport cancelled due to fears he planned to travel to Syria in 2015. Despite being known to hold radical views, he was not being actively monitored by Australian security agencies and had been assessed as not posing a threat to the community. It's thought the attacker moved to Australia from Somalia in the 1990s and that members of his family had been known to police on terrorism-related matters. Victoria State's Chief Police Commissioner is Graham Ashton.
In relation to that person, he is known to police, mainly in respect to relatives that he has that are certainly persons of interest to us. For operational reasons, we now have the Counter-Terrorism Command and the Homicide Squad dealing with this matter, and there are ongoing investigations being conducted by the Counter-Terrorism Command.
Victoria Premier Daniel Andrew says the community won't buckle to extremism.
We will not, as a city and a state, be defined by this act of evil. We'll simply refuse to do that. We will go about our business this weekend and every weekend, because we are bigger and stronger than this.
Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison said extreme Islam is one of the greatest threats to his country. Officials say Australia's terror threat level would remain at probable. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, rising above poverty in Mumbai. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence arrived in Tokyo to discuss North Korea and other issues with Japanese officials before heading to two regional summits. Pence is also discussing China's growing regional influence and bilateral trade with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, according to officials. You can visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, in the heart of India's financial capital, Mumbai, lies one of the largest slums in the world. A group of underprivileged children from there is making their bridge to the world outside their slum. And by using one of the most common items in their modest homes, the children create beautiful sounds. VOA's Rital Joshi reports from Mumbai.
Dharavi, known as the largest slum in Asia. In this maze of narrow alleys that form the underbelly of India's financial capital, Mumbai, even sunlight is scarce. But not all alleys lead to darkness. At the end of this dingy lane, a narrow staircase leads many children to a shining horizon that offers learning and opportunity. A non-profit group called Acorn Foundation has been working with children here for 10 years.
We have to create ways for them to leave the slums of Dharavi. They should feel that they have a chance to lead better lives.
In 2008, Acorn Foundation came up with a way to channel the children's creative energy by using recycled plastic drums to create music. Soon, Dharavi Rocks was born. Impressed with the initiative, many musicians joined in to help train the children.
Every kid can play on this equipment in their own home. So what we use to play music will not cost them anything because they can find this at home. These buckets and drums is where we started this whole thing.
Dharavi Rocks has put on over 150 performances so far across India and even in London. Some members have landed roles in Hindi films. The band often gets a chance to rub shoulders with stars from the Indian film industry.
We had gone to meet Aaliyah Bhatt. We had a three-day dance practice and I went every day. It was a lot of fun.
We have appeared on TV, newspapers, YouTube. We are getting a lot of recognition because of the band.
I like to learn and play here. We laugh and joke a lot and have lots of fun.
And the children also learn freestyle dance to channel their creative energy. Over the last decade, almost 10,000 children have been trained here. Most children leave the band as they grow older. But many say Dharavi Rocks help them escape the bleak reality of life in the slum and reclaim part of their childhood. Ritul Joshi, VOA News, Mumbai, India.
News from VOA Asia. A frank dialogue between Chinese and U.S. defense chiefs has taken the two countries into a temporary calm period after a series of rival military moves in the contested South China Sea as U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis met with his Chinese counterpart. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a university in London is looking at new ways to use technology that displays fully three-dimensional images. They're hoping academics and experts can use the technology to deliver lectures in the classroom remotely. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo has more.
In what's believed to be a first, London's Imperial College Business School is using holographic technology to present lectures to students. From California, Marilee Nika, Google's product manager, was beamed onto a stage like magic.
Can you see me?
The head of Imperial's EdTech Lab says this presents a window to the world.
Through holograms, we can bring in lecturers from across the globe, and they can appear in front of our students in a realistic manner. That's the key.
The developer of the technique explains how it works.
We're presenting a 2D image as a 3D image. And the iris is flat. So we see everything in 2D, our brain changes it to 3D. So we're doing exactly the same trick. We're presenting a 2D image, but with depth of field and a really good vision, our brain just changes it to 3D.
Underlying how clothes were made.
Attendees say there are many ways this tool can help educators and students.
With time differences, for example, Asian students, it's not so easy to catch up a lecture in the US, for example. The second thing we could do with that is have CEOs come into the classroom and engage with students. And the third way probably is maybe have Albert Einstein coming into the classroom.
There might be a long wait for that. Meanwhile, master's student Josephine Collin says she prefers the interaction a hologram lecture offers compared to those presented online.
I wouldn't mind it, and I think it's really interesting if we can have access to different lectures and different like guest speakers. Thanks to that technology, that's something I would definitely enjoy.
Thank you all. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Developers say the cost of holographic technology has dropped considerably since the days it was used mostly in big-budget music shows, making it possible for educational institutions to afford it. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Robots have been put to work assembling cars in factories. They can answer questions at conventions and hotel lobbies, move packages in warehouses, and a whole lot more. And now a team at the University of Southern California is studying how well robots work with autistic children to offer personalized support and learning, Faith Lapidus reports.
6-year-old Adrian is playing a game with his robot friend, Kiwi.
This is some great work.
Adrian is on the autism spectrum, and Kiwi is no toy. It's a socially assistive robot.
You are doing really great. Keep up the good work.
Social assistive robotics is a new field that we actually founded about 15 years ago based on the ability of robots to help people. Many children on the autism spectrum can respond positively to robots and, in fact, can be motivated and learn social skills.
With support from the National Science Foundation, roboticist Maya Mutarek and a team are building and programming these unique robots in their lab at the University of Southern California. They even worked with a puppeteer to design its look. It's part of a first-of-its-kind field study designed to see how children like Adrian would benefit from having a socially assistive robot in the home.
This is truly above and beyond. Wonderful work.
So the goal is to really study what happens when the robot is in the home for an extended period of time.
Oh, we have 3 robots deployed right now.
Professor Mutarek and her students work closely with educational psychologist Giselle Rugosa. She's helped develop the game content, recruit families, and assess the progress of the children in the program.
The idea behind the whole in-home experience is that we want to bring the intervention and the therapeutic interaction to the child at their level, in their environment, with the kind of comfort that they have and need at home, so that they can select to interact at a time that is best and optimal for their learning and for their social behaviors.
Early results are promising. The children's math skills are improving, and the data sets collected by the robots are huge.
For every session where the child and the robot are interacting, we're getting video, audio, we're getting performance on the game, so there's so much to analyze.
What I'm having the annotators annotate for is eye gaze.
The team documents as much as they can, everything from eye gaze to verbal responses.
So we're hoping to collect enough data to where we can train some machine learning algorithms so that our robot could get better over time in adapting to each child.
I'm sorry, that's not the right answer. You'll get it next time.
In addition to supplementing the interactions a child has with a human therapist, socially assistive robots could help people who are isolated, lonely, or depressed.
They could fill in where people cannot be to help other people. That's the idea. Not that they're replacing people, but when there is no one else, someone or something should be there.
A friend in need is a friend indeed, whether human or robot. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can find our program in many different places online, like iTunes and SoundCloud. You can follow us every day on VOA Asia Facebook as we stream our program, and check out some of the other stories we post each and every day there as well. We're also on our website, voanews.com, and you can find our entire full-length programs there, also programs from previous days if you happen to miss one and want to check it out. It's all right there at voanews.com. We're also found on the radio. Many great radio stations across Asia carry our program, like CCU Radio at National Chung-Cheng University in Taipei, Taiwan. Thanks to everyone there who tuned in today. And our thanks always go to Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Dan Crafton, Managing Editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team. That's Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.